Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Radio Edutalk. My name is David Noble, and I'm delighted to host this very special show, which is a follow-up to the e-assessment conference, which took place recently up at the University of Dundee, as ever. We've got two guests this evening. We've got Peter Reid and Mark Glynn. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Good evening.
And maybe we'll start with Peter. Could you give us a brief background to your career in education, and then I'll pop a similar question to Mark?
Right, how long have we got for this one? I've been working in educating higher education for the last 10 years or so, straight out of uni, actually, and I kind of fell into technology. I kind of trained in education and moved into e-learning. It seems like a lifetime ago now. I moved through various positions from learning technologist to project manager, started teaching about 5 or 6 years ago, I think, 5 years ago maybe, in higher education, and moved across a couple of the different institutions in the northwest of England, from John Moores to Edgehill University to Manchester Met, and now I'm currently employed at the University of Liverpool. It's like the role I've got at the moment is a split role. So I'm a lecturer, but I also coordinate learning, technology enhanced learning. So it is a nice balance in the role, which I think works well.
And yourself, Mark?
Yeah, I work for Dublin City University, heading up the teaching enhancement unit there. I'm there just under 2 years now. At this stage, like Peter, I have went from one institution to the next, slightly changing roles along the way. I'm a chemist by trade. I've a PhD in chemistry, but I'm lecturing just a little over 10 years now between part-time and full-time roles, and moved into the area of learning technology. Again, like Peter, kind of fell into it because it was something I was passionate about, integrating into the chemistry teaching. And then an opportunity came up where they said, "You'd like that technology stuff, Mark. Do you want to go into it a little bit more full time?" And it went from just mentoring some of my colleagues to actually doing that on a full time basis and helping lecturers integrate technology into their classroom.
That's fantastic. Thanks, guys. And as ever, if you've got a question or comment for either of our guests this evening, you can get in touch in two ways. You can email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk, or if you're on Twitter, you can pop something up there with the hashtag edutalk, and we'll be live on air for the next 25 minutes or so. Now, got to be open from the top. You know, I really enjoy the assessment conference every year, but I didn't manage to get it to this year. And John was certainly there, and so was Radio Edutalk. But can you, maybe starting off with Mark, could you give us a flavour of the kind of key themes in your eyes at this year's conference, and also what you brought to the table, so to speak?
What I love about the conference itself is the whole networking and the opportunity for networking, where we share good practice. And that's what stands out for me every year about the particular conference. But for me, the themes really came around data and measuring our and analysing our practice, both. And if I just rub something I learned from Peter's talk, really, looking at it from different aspects, not just your own. So I particularly like that, seeing it through other people's viewpoint. And they were the take-home messages, really, for me.
And Peter, you delivered a keynote on the day, so putting you in the spot here a bit. But what were the kind of key messages that you were bringing?
Well, we both delivered the keynote, and Mark just robbed half of mine, I think.
Yeah, I was trying to lead you in there. I was trying to lead you in, right, Seeing how good it was.
Smooth. Yeah. So I kind of delivered the two-part keynote on the day. And the largest message that came from my talks were exactly what Mark just said, trying to emphasise the importance of thinking from other people's perspectives. So we used Brookfield's lenses of reflection as like a useful metaphor, if you like, to try and think about some of the bigger issues related to using technology in assessment, and think from these different perspectives. So whether we look at you know, the kind of the frustrations that we might have and some of the challenges, then maybe we need to step outside of our own perspective and look at maybe the exams office and the team that manage different exams, or consider the different systems that are in play. So that was one of the things. We delved into one of the examples in particular that we delved into was this idea of visualizing assessment timelines. So if we think of all the different types of assessments that we do or that our students do, try and visualize that so we can actually see graphically where about in the calendar our students would do the different types of assessment, and really start to use that to change the way we assess students. So that was one of the big messages. And also picking up on Mark's keynote there was about data and analytics. We did show some data in there about what we can do with data related to assessments in terms of analysing a group of students' performance, or analysing academic staff performance. Really, one of the key messages was questioning the kind of some of the ethics around how we should use that data and if at all we should use that data. So they were some of the key points for me, I think.
Yeah, if I can add to that as well, please. What came across for me was the fact that looking at this data, from my perspective, from my keynote, it dovetailed in quite well with Peter's stuff, because he was talking about the benefits of visualizing it, and we were able to say, well, here's data that you can then use to implement what Peter was talking about. So I think the talks complemented one another quite well. But what happened really was it just started to generate a discussion. And at the end of it, where we were trying to tie it all up, you could really feel that the audience were getting involved and asking questions and genuinely interested, raising issues, just like Peter said there, about the ethics. There was also issues about what do we measure, how do we measure it, and should we measure it at all. So it generated some lovely discussion, and it followed on after the conference as well through the likes of Twitter, and I've had a couple of emails here and there. So it was a great conference.
So this is all about the kind of the big idea that we're now moving away from the kind of high stakes end of unit assessments. Is that right? That from what both of you were saying at the conference, it can be more like a lot of listeners to EduTalk are school teachers, but a more formative approach to assessment.
Well, I think I certainly wouldn't want to dictate to people what they should do, but what both talks, and indeed all the talks that I attended on the day, just highlighted the different opportunities that was out there and the benefits of following particular routes, having a programmatic view, using the data to have a programmatic view on how the assessment is structured across the entire program from a student's point of view. Again, points that Peter brought up very, very well on the day itself.
Yeah, I'd reinforce that the programmatic view and seeing that bigger picture. See, quite often in all education levels, whether it's school, college, or in universities, we often think about just what we teach ourselves. And I think we increasingly need to think of that bigger picture. So when you ask, you know, is it about moving away from high stakes to lower stakes formative, that's certainly one of the things when it's appropriate. But for me, it's also about thinking from that student perspective, and maybe rather than having, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 really high stakes assessments all bunched together at the end, in the same 1 or 2 week period, maybe start to break that down so that, as you say, a bit more formative, a bit less in the higher stakes department, and maybe split them out throughout the module as well. So again, when you're talking about formative assessment, we're really given the opportunity to give some useful feedback and allow that to feed forward into other assessments. I think that's something that's really important.
One of the bits that came across to me was, and it came out in the discussions, I can't take credit for it at all now, but when we want to implement formative assessment within our module, if it clashes with a summative assessment with potentially high stakes assessment delivered by another lecturer on the same program, that students, as students are smart, they will be strategic in what they put their time and effort into. And because your assessment is formative, they won't put as much time and effort into it. And then as a reflection that you would have on your own practice, you may say, oh, well, I'm not doing formative again. Students didn't embrace it at all. It was just a waste of my time. So when you have that programmatic approach to something, and exactly like Peter said there, you don't cluster exams all at one particular time, it actually has the whole experience to perform a little better.
Yeah, I think I gave an example like that myself, Mark, and I, exactly as you say, there could be some real innovative practice taking place in your teaching, but because our students are doing some really high-stakes stuff at the same time, yours can just be washed away, and that, I think that's a real shame.
It's interesting what you're saying there, guys. We had Ken Muir on the show last night. He's the chief executive of the General Teaching Council for Scotland, and there's been new qualifications that have come into schools in Scotland, the new nationals, and one of his recommendations, having produced a report on the experiences of folks in the first year, was to for schools to work very hard on a kind of calendar of assessments. End of unit assessments, higher stakes assessments, and I suppose more kind of formative ones, and that really, if schools could crack that, it would make not only life easier for pupils during the school year, and the workload more manageable. But I think from what you're saying, potentially it would give these types of assessments, maybe using digital technologies, more kind of right a place in within the year's calendar.
Yeah, I think you're dead right. You hit the nail on the head. And if I can add to it a little bit, what I think digital technologies can do to improve it is they can make it more versatile, and they can make sure it's constantly kept up to date. Because I've been in colleges. I've had the privilege of working in a few institutions, as I said at the start. And one in particular had the assessment set in stone from the start of the semester. And they just, even before the year started, they were planned by an individual that wasn't actually teaching the program. So it left no flexibility for the lecturer who's delivering it, who was on the ground working with the students, identifying the issues with the content, to change the assessment structure at all as the module developed. And that was because the structures weren't in place and the technology wasn't in place to give the lecturer that flexibility. Whereas if in an ideal scenario, the lecturer can plan their assessment and structure it in such a way, but if I was running a module and Peter was running a separate module on the same program, Peter would be able to get insight into what my assessment was and how his could either dovetail into it or make sure it doesn't clash with it at a later stage. And that's what technology also affords institutions, because it can help with the collaboration and the coordination of assessments, not just the delivery of the assessments.
And if we're still looking at the kind of formative assessments, then Mark, this is a question from a couple of questions from John, I think, that link in quite nicely at this point. First of all, he's asking, have we evidence for analytics that supports Peter's move to more frequent, less high stakes testing? And also he asks, can analytics be analysed quickly enough to be used formatively?
Yes and yes would be the answers to both questions. Again, because technology has evolved so much, we can process this data much, much quicker. The pure computer power, for want of a better expression, has evolved so much in recent years. It allows us really to have instant results of this analysis that we do. And has it improved the assessment structure, the formative assessment? It's improved it in so many different ways, I think, because what it does is it allows you analyze your own practice as an educator, whether you're a primary, secondary, or indeed a third level teacher. But it also allows the data to be passed back to the students and essentially give it as a form of feedback to the students on their progress. And it's well documented from the research, the quicker you give the feedback to the students, the more impact it will have. And what it would also allow to do, and it's just following on a point from Peter there earlier on, where you can use the feedback from one and use it in your next assessment sort of feed forward, or assessments can be linked together. And that's what the analytics allows you to do. It's not just looking and crunching at numbers. It's that pulling out all sorts of data about assessments and sharing it to the right people at the right time.
Yeah, I think building upon that, I think that everything you've said there, Mark, is spot on. And to build on it, I think we're certainly getting to the point now where the availability of this data is opening up. Additionally, you know, you have to be like a system admin in all these different systems in order to gain access to this data. But things like Turnitin, which is becoming, you know, increasingly available, certainly across higher education, further education, we can, you know, any instructor on a course now can log in and get access to data. And I shared some of this data at the e-assessment conference. And we can really start to use the tools available to us to grade and mark students' work, and then quickly see cohort level data to see, you know, how many students maybe might be suffering with problems related to referencing, or if we're identifying how students construct an argument, you know, if we're constantly leaving comments related to that, we can pull that out and see if this is a big issue, and perhaps we're not doing a good enough job in explaining this to students throughout the, you know, the term, if you like. So I think the availability of all this increases that speed, so teaching staff can get access to this themselves.
If I can get in there, Kenji asked a question there on Twitter about some simple methods of how assessment calendars and schedules could be practically shared. We're very fortunate in DCU, and I'm sure Peter is the same. You could nearly say the statement across all higher education, the resources that we have at our disposal, as opposed to a lot of your listeners that may be in second level or primary level. So we're talking about high fancy technology, high costing technology that you mightn't be able to use. But just at a simple level, you can share information through Google Calendars or a Google Docs. You can design programs and assessment structures there. You don't have to have a Moodle instance or a Blackboard instance. As I say, we're very fortunate that we do, and the Turnitin piece of software that Peter mentioned, the data that's behind that is absolutely fabulous. But I do appreciate that not everybody else is as fortunate as we are within the higher education, at the technologies that's at our disposal. So from a very practical point of view, you could share stuff via a Google Doc. It's constantly kept up to date, and when you change it on your screen, it'll update your colleague's screen at exactly the same time.
That's a really good point. And to be fair, picking up on Kenji's point in a bit more detail, at Liverpool, we've actually we've used PowerPoint and literally just drawn on, 52 weeks in the year, and put a dot on the screen as to what point of the year or what weeks different assessments take place. So you don't necessarily need high expensive technologies. PowerPoint works. If you wanted to share that across a group, you can use, as you said, Google spreadsheets and things like that. And quite often, this information is already held by somebody somewhere at universities or colleges. There's like a program leader. You still have subject leads in schools. So people have this data. I think it's just important that we start to make that data available to everyone that matters, all the different stakeholders. And when I was visualising my timelines, I stumbled across a project from the University of Hertfordshire called the Escape Project. And they'd done a lot of work around this. And I blogged all the work that I was doing. And the University of Greenwich have actually created a tool based on Google Sheets. So you can just drop in your own dates for your different assessments, and it'll visualize it for you. And again, that's a free tool, which we can, you know, if we can share the link somehow, I'll be able to share that on Twitter or whatever. And your listeners might be interested in that.
That's an excellent suggestion. And the Twitter itself is a super tool to share good practice and share information about it, putting specific hashtags in it as well. So there's loads of simple tools that you can use. But what I would say is, don't reinvent the wheel. Put out something along those lines you'd search for on Twitter. You'd be amazed at the responses you get back. And most certainly after this session, I'll be looking up for that link that Peter just alluded to.
just tweeting it right now, buddy.
Super. And in terms of, you were saying about the conference was great for picking up on examples of good practice and networking. So in terms of analytics for assessment, then did either of you learn something new or find out about some good practice that's going on that you weren't aware of previously?
I'm not just saying this to flatter, but I really learned loads from sitting in Peter's session. I say all the sweetest things, really, in fairness. But no, I genuinely mean that. It was refreshing for me to listen to a session like that I could really relate to and actually say, oh, well, hold on, the work we're doing is actually tying into stuff people like Peter are doing in their own organizations. So we're not just going off on a rant, as I can be accused of doing on many an occasion. So that in itself was reassuring. I particularly liked as well some of the other talks, not just limited to learning analytics, but there was some on comparative judgments when it came to assessments. And they were quite appealing as well, albeit I do think with a lot of that stuff and a lot of the learning analytics that you have or could have involves high-costing technology, and that's something your audience mightn't have at their disposal.
I think some of the things that I was particularly interested in at the conference, obviously I'm going to reciprocate and say Mark's keynote was excellent as well.
That's all right then, that's all right.
But I think what was really interesting was to see, I actually can't remember the lady's name now, there was two presentations in the breakout sessions. One was your everyday teacher who had really started to think differently and moved her assessments online, and just sharing her journey I thought was really interesting. And even to the point of moving away from written exams to online exams, and even the process of being able to digitise images within those exams, I thought that was really fascinating. And then there was also a really interesting presentation from a student nurse, actually. I think the student nurse was from York, the University of York, and was talking about ePortfolios, and just how confident and eloquent the student was, I thought was fascinating. And the ability, for a student like that to share her own work in something that's still relatively new, really, ePortfolios in the nursing curriculum. So I thought both examples there were excellent.
And Peter, one of the other things that John has spoken to me about after the conference was one of your messages about integrating digital technologies into the curriculum, and he took the message from your keynote that there was an implication there that it was student as producer. Now, is that within the kind of learning processes, or again, are you talking about student as producer within certain types of assessments?
A bit of both, actually. It was something that I mentioned that it frustrates me really, because I believe that a fundamental aspect of education in preparing students for a 21st century career and world, it's important that they are using the different digital technologies and everyday skills that you would need on the web. Now, the web 2 is about creating. So I think it's really important that our students are comfortable with creating different things using the web. And that's not something that doesn't happen already. And the various tech, when I was talking about this at the conference, I flashed up an image, two images really to compare. How do we go from this image that we see every day in classrooms across the country of students using iPads or different smart devices, either on their own or to collaborate? How do we go from that situation to a situation where we have, 300 students in a sports hall writing an exam using a pen and paper, in a situation where students don't even write with a pen and paper anymore? It doesn't happen anymore. The only time they come across pen and paper these days is for university exams or college exams. And I think we really need to get with the times there. So student as producer happens throughout the curriculum as well as through assessments, because we want students to really develop stuff, no matter whether it might be video, move away from traditional assessments that aren't even relevant anymore to things that are much more relevant and actually useful and practical.
I wholeheartedly agree. I think using novel ways, and to be honest, even using the word novel is wrong. Using ways that students use these tools every single day of the week, they should be integrated into the curriculum. Like the amount of video, say, for example, is something there that touched on. Video now is so ubiquitous. We all have smartphones. We could take a video in a matter of seconds and it'll be up on Twitter or up on Vine or up on YouTube or what else have you. Guaranteed, if you fall down the stairs in front of your students, that video will be on Twitter before you know it. Yeah. And then we do exactly what Peter said there. We put them in an exam hall where we ask them to write with a pen and piece of paper. We really have to get with it because my own daughter, I've an 18-year-old daughter, and she doesn't watch TV anymore. She streams stuff on YouTube, looks at stuff, follows people on YouTube and looks at programs there. The whole concept, she doesn't even know why a TV should have buttons on it, never mind the fact that we had a remote control. They've just moved completely off the scale as to what we're talking about. And then we put them in that dusty gym hall where we asked them to use this thing called a pen and piece of paper to sit for 3 hours and write nonstop. I can't remember the last time I sat for 3 hours and wrote nonstop. Mm. So it's not as if we're training them to work in the workplace. This 3 hour non-stop writing will actually benefit them in that respect.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of during lectures and classes and such, like, you know, you've got somebody like Clay Shirky now saying that he's finding that the students are, if they're multitasking too long, that it's actually seriously affecting the quality of their learning. Is that again, I wasn't at the conference, but are there some dissenting voices at all, or are you aware of Clay Shirky's recent blog post and others talking similarly? You know, we had a guest on a couple of months ago from a university in Holland who was talking a kind of along this line, saying that nobody can multitask successfully, for example. Therefore, you might have technology in a lecture, but they shouldn't be online and supposedly taking part in the lecture at the same time. It just can't be worthwhile. It can't be fruitful.
I better stop writing this blog post now, shouldn't I?
Yeah. Well, we were sitting there downstairs, sitting room there relatively recently. My wife was on the phone and playing a game on the phone. And my daughter, who was 6, was playing the same game on my phone. And at the same time, my daughter was watching the TV and looking over my wife's shoulder, looking to see how she's doing relative to her mother. And my wife was zoned in on this phone completely and had to concentrate. Kids are able to be flexible, no problem, do 2 and 3 things together. Whereas we're kind of trained nearly to concentrate on the one thing. There's nothing wrong with multitasking.
Yeah, I think multitasking... Clay Shirky always comes out with these posts, doesn't he? And it starts to... Hasn't he recently banned laptops from classes completely?
I believe so, yes.
Which I think is rubbish. So, multitasking, there might be more into that, maybe. But people are multitasking increasingly these days. Whether that impacts on learning or not, I don't know. I don't remember seeing a lot of evidence around that. There might be there, but... I think that's one to watch. I think
if you embrace the technologies and encourage multitasking, but also shape the multitasking, influence what they're actually doing in the other tasks. If they're bored, they'll get distracted.
Yeah,
you know, they'll be on Facebook if your lessons are rubbish.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if you're engaging your students, then they're going to be on task.
Yeah, like if you go and you say, right, okay, go on to YouTube, say, for example, and find a decent video on X, whatever it may be, or and it's relevant to the curriculum. Yeah, you'll get some of them searching about dogs on skateboards and ice bucket challenges and all sorts of other videos that'll be on YouTube. But over time, if you keep them engaged and getting them using the technologies they're going to use anyway, they'll learn stuff. Whether they like it or not, they will actually learn stuff.
Now we're just coming into the last 5 minutes of tonight's show, and I'll just say that we've got another question from Kenji, actually. So, gentlemen, I don't know if you want to have a look at that just while I'm letting listeners know that you can email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk or you can use the hashtag edutalk. Kenji's asking, this is going back to assessment data that we're talking about at the top of the show. Kenji asks, should employers have greater access to student assessment data, beyond a simple A to C or a percentage, for specific subjects?
Really interesting question. I should really let Mark answer the difficult questions, but I did give an example on this at the conference a couple of weeks ago. The answer is, possibly yes, and possibly no. Do employers need to know if a student was late a couple of times? I mean, the students, let them be students. I was a student once, and I think it's important to be a student. So some things might not be fair for employers to see. But there's a project in the Liverpool School of Dentistry at the moment called what's it called? It's called Lift Up. And it's about longitudinal assessment, and you're basically able to see a lot of data about the student journey. And in this particular instance, because of the dentist, you can see, as a member of staff, all the different teeth that any particular student has worked on, as well as every single different procedure they've worked on. So you can really get a big holistic picture of what that student's able to do, and that is much more detailed than a simple A to C. So when the student graduates, they get this as a portfolio. They can take that away, go to employers and say, right, these are all the procedures I've done. I am, a more than competent dentist. Employ me. So I think in that example, that could be really, really effective. I can't see what more an employer would want in that situation.
If I can go in there as well, that one of the last bits that Peter mentioned was the portfolio. And the key difference between the portfolio and the virtual learning environment, in my opinion, is that the portfolio was controlled by the student, whereas the VLE and all its inherent assessment data that's buried within it is controlled by the institution. Yeah. For me, the student should have that data belong to themselves, and if they choose to share it through their e-portfolio, they should have that it's their choice to make, essentially. So if Kenji's question is, should employers have greater access from the institution, I would say no, because we'd have a data protection issue there. But in the avenues, the way Peter explained, through a portfolio, that is by choice then of the student. And that's actually making it easy for the student to share their relevant assessment data or to them, something that's relevant to that particular post. If I'm making a CV, I hone my CV towards the particular job position that I'm applying for. You should be able to do the same with your assessment data. Highlight your good points relevant to the employers. Would you like your employer going onto your Facebook page, say, for example, and having a look at the stuff you do everywhere and every time? But would you want them going onto your e-portfolio, the stuff that's relevant to the job? I think that's a better solution.
I think what's important there with the portfolio option as well is that, possibly more important than just saying, look at my final grades, what about the whole journey? So a portfolio could say, this is where I started out. I didn't have any idea about these issues, and this is where I started out in first year, and this is where I am now, and I've made this journey, and I have accomplished a lot and learned a lot. I think that journey is very important for employers as well.
Yeah, big time. It's the growth of the individual throughout. And that says it all as well. You're not always going to be top of the class, but if you're the best improved along the way, that sometimes can be better off.
Again, coming back to the conference, guys, were there examples then of portfolios, either commercial or people being innovative, doing it kind of different ways themselves? Then we're talking Scottish Education about e-portfolios, and we've used Glow, and we've used various kind of free online tools and such like in the past, and there's still debate and discussion about what the best forms are. But one feature of the conference down the years is that you get health professionals, you get people from social work and education all mixing together. So for us, traditional educationalists, are there any tools out there, any products or approaches that we might learn from in the other professions?
I think that's really interesting. But I think it's important to recognise that any portfolio means different things to different subjects. And this is something I always end up having to emphasise to people. Any portfolio to a nurse or a trainee teacher, for example, is about evidencing professional standards. You know, these professional bodies say you need to do these 100 or however many items in order to be a qualified teacher or a qualified nurse or a dentist. And that's what the e-portfolio is about. It's about ticking that list off. But if you speak to a computing student or an artist about what a portfolio is, it's about demonstrating their work. So firstly, I think the problem is in defining what kind of e-portfolio you need. And then there was some interesting work when I worked at Manchester Metropolitan University. Listeners might be aware of Mark Stubbs, who leads a lot of the great work there. And he done a lot of work in canvassing employers about what they wanted from e-portfolios, from student e-portfolios. And a lot of the feedback from that was, we don't want a university to build the e-portfolio for the students. We want to see your students choosing different tools that suit their needs and that are most appropriate, and then demoing their own work and sharing the good practice. And it's about the student decisions in that process that's important for some employers. So it makes the e-portfolio argument much more complex and a difficult one to grasp. It shows that there might be Google tools, like Google Sites, for example, that students could use, or whether it's, you know, they might use LinkedIn and some plugins for LinkedIn to demonstrate the visual work. Or you could go down the institutional road, like the University of Liverpool are currently buying into PebblePad, which is quite an expensive system that's used across HE, or any other number of tools out there.
Yeah, I would echo that a difference, any portfolio requirements is different from subject to subject, discipline to discipline, and possibly from one institution to another. Not everybody is going to have the technology and the budget available to invest in software. But what I would say is, if you can get any package that can show the growth of an individual throughout, show their learning journey. Google Sites was mentioned there by Peter, and PebblePad. There's a range of them out there, but what works for one mightn't work for the other. I would always encourage lecturers, teachers, educators at every level to be led by the pedagogy rather than the technology. And with that, there's been loads of people that have ran projects up and down the UK and indeed Ireland in the areas of e-portfolios. And I would highly recommend going onto a website from an organization called JISC, J-I-S-C. And I'll tweet the URL now in a second. But they've put together some fabulous research projects on the use of e-portfolios. And if anybody's interested, I would definitely recommend that as your first port of call.
Yeah, but JISC have got a transform and assessment toolkit from JISC. So if you was to Google JISC transform and assessment, you'll come across this toolkit, and there's lots of stuff in there. It'll go into your portfolios, but it'll also go into a whole host of other things that you might feel useful as well.
That's really helpful, and we'll just finish up there, guys. So I'd just like to thank Mark Glynn and Peter Reid for joining us this evening on Radio EduTalk. Thank you so much. And Kenji's asked me just to point out that at www.e-assessment-scotland.org you can sign up for the two remaining aspects of the Assessment Scotland conference, the online version of it, on Thursday the 18th of September, which is tomorrow evening, at now 8 a.m. I've got it down for. I'll need to check that one, see if it's maybe 8 p.m. We've got open source safe exam browser for bring your own device e-exams, and then on Friday at 8 o'clock, also for 60 minutes, that's Friday the 19th of September, is a talk entitled 10 years of e-exams at a university in Berlin, so worth tuning into. So thanks again, Mark and Peter, and best wishes for the future.
Thank you. No worries. Thanks for your time. Thank you.